Good morning, and thank you for joining the Hospice New Zealand Palliative Care Lecture Series. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. Please be advised that today's call is being recorded on the 5th of May 2016. Our speaker today is Dr. Brian Ensor. Brian is Director of Palliative Care at Mary Potter Hospice and also Clinical Advisor to Hospice New Zealand. We are delighted he can join us to present today. Welcome, Brian. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Kia ora koutou. Thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to speak on behalf of the team. Last year, Mary Potter Hospice organised a day-long symposium on dyspnea called Breathless, which brought a range of disciplines together to talk about dyspnea. This talk's a bit of a summary of the day as seen through my eyes. So I've brought together three or four lectures in this 45 minutes. One by my sister Janet, who's a respiratory physio on normal breathing, and resources from our physio and OT team at Mary Potter on non-pharmaceutical, some of Professor Curro's work, and some of my own hobby horses, which I should identify as such. Next slide. I mean, it is complicated, multifaceted even. This is a holiday snap. It's a sculpture in the Brisbane Botanical Gardens called Morning Star. So I'm not going to do justice to every facet, but I'm going to whip through what interests me. Next slide, please. So look, when I'm approaching any patient, I have this generic action cycle, which looks a lot like a quality action cycle, that plan, do, check, adjust thing that we know. Planning comes third in my cycle, and the first is this word attend. I'm not sure it's the right word. You'll have your own word. It's about turning up to the appointment, obviously, but in all sorts of other ways, we attend to the person with us, their unique story, their mana, their personhood. It's probably a discussion for another day, but it means something to me. To understand is that complicated two-way process leading to a mutual understanding of what the issues are. And then you make your plans, you negotiate the way forward, you set in motion some therapy, etc. Next slide. So even within these areas, I'm going to be selective. There's quite a bit of work trying to understand what patients mean when they say they are breathless. And there's quite a bit of work being done on models of breathlessness. And so I want to marry the two. And half the session is going to be talking about that. And then the second half of this lecture, I want to talk about therapy. Slide five. The simplest definition of dyspnea, it's a subjective experience of breathing discomfort. So subjective is the key word. You cannot necessarily tell if somebody has dyspnea. The very quiet breathing of a patient with motor neuron disease may invoke greater distress than somebody obviously tachypneic and breathing hard. People have tried to correlate the experience of dyspnea with measurable physiological things like respiratory function and blood gases and even physical functioning, but the correlation is disappointing almost to the point of being useless. In a way, that's okay. In our business, we are treating the experience, not the measurements. We know pain is recognized to have sensory and emotional components, correlating to input to the sensory cortex and the limbic cortex, and so does dyspnea have these discrete elements? We commonly split dyspnea into an intensity component and an emotional or unpleasant component. And so you see on the football field, people are staggering around, puffing and blowing and holding onto their knees to breathe, but they're full of the joys of playing a game. It's intense, but it's not unpleasant. That functional component is a bit of an add-on as people describe what their breathlessness is in terms of what they can and what they cannot do. Slide six. Exploring a little bit more functionality is not about walking or lifting necessarily. It's about the bigger roles that are affected, the ability to fulfill your life's purpose, whether that's speaking on a marae or being part of family conversations. These need to be part of the assessment of dyspnea. When speech is reduced to a whispered few words with motor neuron, it is distressing for everyone. Slide seven. So we have these different dimensions of dyspnea. and we try and correlate them with the different words that people use. And so there's discussion about how much language correlates with underlying physiology. And again, like trying to correlate intensity with physiological measurements, the correlation is disappointing. But for me, there is still value. The description of chest tightness being a hallmark of asthma is well described. Choking and the stimulation of irritant receptors in the trachea similarly. Paint fumes or perfumes or other smells give some people a feeling of choking because their irritant receptors are activated. It's not actually a swelling or closing of the respiratory tract. The most recent study on language I saw found the only significant finding was feelings of hopelessness, etc., were well matched with the diagnosis of COPD. Air hunger, the ability of not being able to get enough air, like holding your breath underwater, it's an activating experience. It makes you want to get up and fight for air. People who are struck with an embolus often want to get out of bed, they want to sit up, they want to fight it. Whereas exhaustion, people who describe their breathlessness in terms of exhaustion, I think, are different. They want to rest and concentrate on their breathing. In our business, particularly towards the end of life, it's often a mixture of the two, particularly when exhaustion starts to get universal. Slide number 8. Despite the lack of correlations and stuff, we do try and measure breathlessness to test our therapies and carry out our research. So the most common and simplistic is the simple Likert scale from 0 to 10. It's unit dimensional. And look, I haven't listed the others because I'm not sure that we particularly use them. You'll hear about the Borg scale, which is a rating of perceived exertion, first used in sport. It combines numbers and words. So a 5 is described as strong or breathing hard. 10 is described as when you're so breathless you have to stop. There's a Medical Research Council scale. It's been used for half a century. It talks about what you can do before you get short of breath. Modern multidimensional scales like the chronic respiratory questionnaire have more dimensions. The CRQ's got 4. Dyspnea, emotional function, fatigue, mastery. So mastery is sort of an interesting one. It talks about questions about confidence and being in control. So there's a range of scales. When I read the hospice notes, I seldom see numbers. I tend to see descriptive words and assessments of functions. Can they get up to the toilet? Can they lie in bed? How many words can they say? That sort of thing. And I think that's fair enough. On to slide 9, which I guess further in line with pain, just recognises Amy Abernathy and the others proposing the idea of total dyspnea, which underlies the multidimensional nature of dyspnea. I've added social to the slide, which is implicit in the idea that she talks about, but it's not isolated. But the CRQ has questions about embarrassment about coughing all the time and embarrassment about phlegm, and it's important. And I alluded to the loss of important roles previously, which is a social phenomenon. Slide number 9 is a respiratory observation scale for people who cannot communicate. Might be dementia or stroke. It's simple. Margaret Campbell's an American PhD nurse. I put it in for completeness. It's better than nothing. Okay. Moving on to my sister's slide. What is normal breathing? So it's an interesting study in how we breathe in different situations. Even childhood experiences can change how you breathe. Our breathing patterns are adaptable over time. We can breathe in funny ways. And normal breathing looks differently if you're in pain, if you're frightened, if you're dancing, if you have a head cold, if you're dancing with somebody with a head cold, your normal patterns of breathing are different. Next slide. This is a quote that I've used before. It's funny, but you never really think about breathing until it's all you ever think about. Breathing should be automatic and gentle. We shouldn't really need to think about it unless we're learning to surf or sing or play brass. I thought this was from a COPD patient. Actually, it's from a novel called Breathe. It's about two teenage Australians into surfing and extreme sports, but the quote still stands. Slide number 13. What normal breathing at rest? 80% diaphragm, 20% chest, 10 to 14 breaths a minute. Expiration is longer than inspiration. You have a gentle pause at the end of exhalation. A gentle inhale, an effortless exhale, minimal muscle activity. And so you can see why breathing is a spiritual exercise in a way that feeling your pulse or monitoring your renal function perhaps isn't. It should be peaceful. Slide 14 shows the muscles involved. On the left are the in-breathing muscles, the diaphragm, the intercostal, with those accessory muscles if you need to use them. A natural lung has enough recoil. They actually don't need muscles to breathe out. But if you do need muscles, the intercostals and the tummies come into play. Slide number 15. The Nijmegen questionnaire used to diagnose hyperventilation. Even in healthy people, breathing is disordered. And so things like chest pain and confusion and bloating and tingling and stiffness and feeling I can't breathe are symptoms of hyperventilation, which is not just breathing too much, but it's breathing in the wrong way, using the wrong muscles. Now, this could be a holiday snap. It was a sculptor I met in Brisbane. It's called The Guardian. He has a dog head. He's in shorts with gumboots carrying a tree on his back. But why he makes it into physiology is because he has got a hole in his chest. You can see inside him. The intention is that he has a visible soul. And this is an introduction to looking at what happens inside people. So slide 17. So the essential idea that I'm trying to move towards is that dyspnea is a mismatch. Now I'm going to describe it in three ways, assuming that this first slide doesn't do it for you. But it does describe where we're going. It's from Professor Curro's paper. And I'm not even sure I want to read it. Let's move on to slide 17, which sort of summarizes it to say dyspnea is a mismatch. What the brain expects is not what it feels it is getting. So this is the second way that I try and explain it. It's slide 19. So this is a circuit that starts in the respiratory centres in the brain stem with the respiratory pace-setting cells, which give orders to breathe in and breathe out. Actually, they're separate circuits, the breathe-in circuits and the breathe-out circuits. And their paces set by information they're getting from peripheral chemoreceptors measuring oxygen and CO2, and some information from muscles and thermoreceptors. And so if you start to exercise, it's your muscles that drive up your respirations and not necessarily your CO2. In heart failure, it seems that these reflexes are exaggerated, so a small amount of exercise is perceived by the brainstem as really something major and sets off pronounced shortness of breath. But we might come back onto that. But it's all unconscious. The next slide, I want to just talk briefly about brainstem breathing, because none of this really involves the sensory cortex. Agonal breathing is that very end-of-life breathing. After a cardiac arrest, it's not functional, it doesn't last very long. Change Stokes is common for us, where the respiratory pace setters, the inspiratory ones, are not firing properly in response to feedback. So again, common in heart failure, end of life, and opioids. What I want to say about that is that if you just flick in and watch somebody breathing hard and restless and assume that it's that they're generally tachypneic and give them opioids, you may not be doing them a favour. That hypoxic catch-up bit is often marked by restlessness. But opiates can make the apneas worse and aggravate it rather than help it, but we might discuss that more. Cusmo, acidotic breathing, diabetes, renal failure at the end of life, when people are trying to breathe off acid, big regular breaths without a pause, that's a and it's the brainstem trying to correct the acid balance. Apneas, long pauses, we know those are not necessary. Look, I've gone dizzy. back with you, sleep apneas, an example of that. Ondine's curse, generally a specific congenital disorder where automatic breathing during sleep fails, and babies have a respiratory arrest when they sleep. But it can happen with brain or spinal cord injuries. So something that I came across recently, which I think is important, but which has opened the discussion, is that you can reverse the opioid depression of the respiratory centres by giving serotonergic drugs. You're not reversing the analgesia, you're just reversing the respiratory depression by pumping those circuits full of serotonin, which is both good and bad. And again, we'll come back to that one. Slide 21, just to get back to the explaining of the mismatch. As well as firing off instructions to the motor cortex, the brainstem fires off instructions to the sensory cortex. And this is the corollary discharge. It means the sensory cortex has a blueprint of what should be happening. And so it can check that this is happening. And on the next slide, which is 22, you see that it's getting input from multiple receptors, and so it can check off what it's getting from these receptors against what the corollary discharge is saying it should be getting in terms of muscle movement, shifting of air, and that sort of thing. And if these two things match each other, you should not get dyspnea. Slide 23 is the slide of the multiple receptors that I'm talking about, our old friends, the peripheral chemoreceptors, CO2, oxygen, and pH. Muscle receptors, which measure the amount of effort, the metabolism, the posture, the movement. Information from lung receptors, looking at congestion, distortion, irritation. Blood pressure and in the blood vessels and in the lungs. Nosis is receptors for pain are feeding in there, and whether the face and oropharynx is cold feeds in there. So chapter 20, slide 24. You can jog along quite happily, shifting twice the amount of air that you were a minute ago, and it feels fine because the expectations are being met. Push yourself a little harder and the lights start to come on. So slide 25, the muscles start to fatigue, there's a bit of metabolic build-up, and this is recognised as dyspnea. In a COPD patient, the chest is overinflated, the diaphragm gets flattened and inefficient, the accessory muscles start to be called on, they tire quickly, and this is not right. And the body feels dyspnea. It activates the corticolimbic structure that also subserves interoceptive awareness and nociceptive sensations like pain and fear and thirst and hunger. Okay, those same sort of structures are being activated by dyspnea. Slide 5. So here we go with the third attempt to explain the simple thing, and I do want to make a specific point through this one. Slide 27, you will know the basic layout of a Federation starship with Captain Kirk at the bridge, Montgomery Scott and engineering. Slide number 28. So this is the thing. There is a constant dialogue between bridge and engineering. And if all is going well, you should have no distress. Let me see if I can give you a real-life example.
This is Spock. Captain. Pull ahead. Warp factor one. Warp factor one, Captain.
And so those are all very happy sounds. If there is a problem in the engineering...
Captain, we're losing power on the warp engines.
You'll start to get some distress signals in from the from engineering. Let me see if I can call up a distress.
We can't do it. If we keep this speed, we'll blow up any minute now.
Okay, and so that's a sign of distress, and Captain Kirk will be receiving that as an alarm, and that is the analogy between dyspnea. I want to bring in anxiety in here a little as well, because there is this backdrop that makes everything worse in this particular program. Signifies anxiety. It's a useful little thing. If I'm at, you probably use that in real life. If you say, Bob, I'd like to see you now. Or Sharon, your mother's on the phone. You get the idea that the basic input is being altered by anxiety. Let's move on to slide 29. That was slide 29. Let's move on to slide 30. The multiple receptors. So the list of inputs that are going into the bridge or the cortex. Now, most of them are processes, not outcome. However, the whole ventilatory pump exists primarily to keep the oxygen coming and the CO2 going. And certainly that's an important thing to monitor. For Captain Kirk, he wants to know how fast his ship is going. For us, we want to know what our blood gases are. It's fair to say that acute medicine is focused on outcome. If you attend A&E with dyspnea, you get an upgrade if your blood gases are abnormal. If they are normal, I think the system is a little less interested in you. If you have fatigued muscles, distorted bronchial tree, they're less fixable, they're less miserable. Palliative care, however, is interested in that. In fact, we may be more guilty of taking minimal interest in the outcomes and much more in the processes. But I'm going to stick with acute medicine for a little while. Slide 31. This is a representative list of cardiopulmonary causes of dyspnea, which may be seen in any house surgeon's notebook. It's obviously not a definitive list, and they all deserve treatment. Slide 32 is a list of treatments for dyspnea. They involve taking off fluid, taking off pus. They can take off bugs or drugs. You can add blood, you can add steroids, you can add a bit of oncology. Anticoagulation should probably be on that list too. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them because they are not particularly what I do, or is it? Slide 33. Salina, your party and I from Tamanga were putting in a paper about a palliative care paper about COPD to a journal, and it was being reviewed by respiratory physicians, which was a shock and surprise to us, but there you go. And they wanted to know whether our patients were on maximal treatment for their COPD, and I was thinking, I don't know, actually. I haven't kept up to date with what the guidelines for maximal treatment for COPD disease is. And so here is the question, is that our responsibility? How responsible are we to make sure the patients referred to us have had maximal treatment according to standard guidelines for respiratory or heart failure? I mean, we sort of have a feeling that we do it with oncology, but I'm not sure that we do it with heart failure. I have the joy of working with a medical registrar every day, and they keep me on the straight and the narrow, but I do rely on them. Slide 34. This is my list of the causes of dyspnea, and so I put muscle weakness, fatigue, effort of breathing at the top. These things are inevitable with advanced disease. If you look at a graph on the incidence of symptoms towards the end of life in the last 6 weeks, you see the incidence of dyspnea rising, even though it's not with heart failure or lung. These are people whose lungs should be okay. But the incidence of dyspnea rises as people get exhausted. We accept that people's legs get tired and they don't walk and they sit down and they stay in bed. Yeah, well, the same's happening with the respiratory muscles. They're just getting tired. Slide 35, the management of dyspnea. It's a bit of a summary slide. We're going to go through it in detail. We reduce their respiratory drive. I have no qualms about using oxygen for hypoxic patients. We'll discuss that a bit later. Reducing noxious input is getting less bad news through to Captain Kirk. Reducing the noxious input with better, with more efficient muscles, less provocation, using some opioids are good. And giving him some more good news. Fool him into thinking he's zooming through the universe when perhaps he's not. And chest vibrations, getting some wind in the face, does that sort of thing. Slide 36. The non-pharmaceutical is the bulk of our treatment. And Joe and Tanya and Tracy have put a lot of resources together and presented this at the Dyspnea slides. Now, it's not my expertise, and I thought, why don't I just leave it out? But actually, this is the bulk of treating dyspnea. You can't leave it out. But I'm going to whip through it fairly smartly to keep on time. So fingers on the button. Slide 37, we teach positioning and posture, helping muscles move efficiently, relax bodies. You should be familiar with these positions. Slide 38, simple breathing retraining, dropping the shoulders, focusing on the out, pursed-lip breathing, centering. More sophisticated techniques are useful to clear secretions. Slide 39 is the active cycle breathing techniques that Joe will use for patients to help clear secretions or cough. Slide 40, the three P's of energy conservation, planning, prioritizing, pacing. Slide 41 is anxiety management. A range of disciplines get involved with this. Slide 42, assessment equipment. Positioning for breathing using those accessory muscles with a walking frame is really useful. I think the bicycle has the same sort of posture. I'm interested in electric bikes with breathless people as long as they don't fall off them. Slide 43, the famous handheld fan. The randomized trial where people put a fan on their shin or a fan on their face, and the face reduce the sensation of breathlessness by activating the trigeminal nerve. Same with oxygen up the nose and in the mouth. Slide 44, we have the privilege of having an acupuncturist, Joe, with us. Two approaches used for anxiety and for breathlessness. Slide 45 mentions acupressure. These beads can be left on for up to a week, and patients can self-massage the points. Slide 46 talks about education and reassurance. Talks about breathless groups and clinics, and I'm going to mention that a little bit later on. Slide 47 talks about breathless plans, and I'm hoping that you're aware of breathlessness plans like pain plans, introducing a little clarity and certainty, which is so important for these people. Slide 48 has a breathless plan, and it's not a generic plan. It's only for Dave. You can't use this plan for anybody else. He's a bit anxious with his breathing. He's using a bit of midazolam, taking a bit of time, distracting himself. So don't use this as a template. This is just an example. Slide 49. Exercise, rehabilitation, the single most important thing for COPD patients to help their breathlessness. Patients set their own goals and it must be individualised. Slide 50, summary slide. Effective symptom management is patients participating in activities that you value. So remember that. It's a functional one from OT and physiotherapy. Slide 51 has their references. Unlike me, you have to ask me for my references, but I do have them. So the last quarter of an hour of this trip, I'm going to talk about general drug treatments. So why don't I do that? Slide 53, starting with morphine. Good evidence that low-dose morphine relieves dyspnea, and pain reverses that relief. So the study that I keep going back to, David Currow's 2011 publication, his dose-finding thing, 83 patients, half of them had COPD. 10% in the 0 to 10 scale was counted as a response. It measured just intensity, it didn't mention function, and you might argue that actually measuring function would have get a better response, because if people are moving more, they can be just as breathless. I'm not saying that right. But the breathlessness stays the same, but their function moves up as their ability allows it. They followed on with a long-term effectiveness study, which showed a continued benefit for most of those responders over 22 months. Number needed to treat 1.6, which is really good. Number needed to harm 4.6, constipation was the big issue. The median dose was 10 milligrams. These are people not on opiates, obviously, for anything else. 10 milligrams, 72% responded to that. About half, 60% responded overall. For those who are already on morphine, the recommendation is to put it up 25%. For me, the study changed my use of short-acting. I tended to be a sort of short-acting sort of guy when it came to morphine. And they're saying long-acting morphine is probably better. And so I'm inclined to agree with that. We give 10 milligrams of morphine before exercise, and actually it doesn't kick in until three-quarters of an hour later, and what's the point? And so there's good evidence for morphine. It's not depressing respiration. And so here's the sort of Kirk versus engineering thing. It's not, this doesn't affect Scotty. Scotty's engines are fine. Scotty's engines might even be a better. We're just dealing with Kirk here. We're just dealing with dyspnea. There's an expectation that Oxy works in a similar sort of fashion, but we don't have a lot of, we have much less evidence. And I don't think we've got any evidence about methadone. We know that it can stop people breathing because people die from taking too much methadone. But the ability to suppress respirations is not necessarily the same as treating dyspnea. Okay. Buprenorphine, a drug on the rise, it's not on this. It's got a ceiling effect on respiration, which means it's safer. It doesn't have a ceiling effect on analgesia, but it does have a ceiling effect on respiration. So keep an eye out for that one. Not in dyspnea, in pain. Slide 54 is fentanyl. So here's an interesting drug. Okay, so we've got randomized double-blind studies that show it works. And so people on fentanyl were given a top-up subcut, up to 7 mils of subcut fentanyl, which I thought was impressive. And there was a significant difference for the active arm from baseline, okay? So these people had better dyspnea scores after their fentanyl subcut. Unfortunately, placebo also had an effect, not as good as fentanyl. The placebo effect wasn't, but the fentanyl effect wasn't significantly different from the placebo effect. It was significantly different from baseline, but it wasn't significantly different from the placebo effect. Sublingual, I'm not a fan of. I prescribe it. Others may plead its cause. It may be an expensive placebo, but placebos work. Eduardo Bruera did a sublingual study. He found that there wasn't any difference, and so I'm not keen. Nebulized fentanyl I've never used, but in the process of working up this talk, there's a lot of sort of people all over the world that are using it and getting great stories. So here we are at the stories. 2002 study from Kansas City in Virginia used nebulized 25 mics and 2 mils of saline. Helped 91%, okay, 91% of their people. Again, no control. Others using 50 mics, so great stories. Bit of debate about the sort of nebulizer that might be used.
But if I was breathless, I would probably want to try nebulous rather than sublingual. I want to go back to that original idea that circuits for hypercapnia, brainstem circuits, particularly are serotonergic. Fentanyl is serotonergic, and so it strikes me that fentanyl for tachypnea at the end of life may not be helpful. Now, move on to slide 55, which is an evidence-free zone. Okay, so this is just me raving. Okay. So, look, I'm not talking about dyspnea per se, which is the sort of subcut fentanyl study. I'm talking about hypercapnic tachypnea. Okay, now I'm talking about an engineering problem. It's not Kirk. It's Scotty. So I've come to this conclusion by being disappointed when I use fentanyl for hypoxic hypercapnic people at the very end of life. It just seems like dishwater. Perhaps it's a dose thing. Perhaps I should be giving more. That might be right. But very occasionally I've been wondering whether it actually made things worse. And recently had a patient that was on fluoxetine and SSRI. And the feeling was that this stuff was firing up her tachypnea. It wasn't making her better. For a while now, we've been using Nozinan as a preferred respiratory depressant at the end of life. And Nozi is anti-serotonergic, and is that the effect that we're seeing? Quetiapin, vitamin Q as it's called, is making inroads into palliative care as a settling, anti-anxious, does it help breathing thing at night. So I'm just making a point, end of life tachypnea is different from dyspnea. Okay. The aim arguably for end of life tachypnea is respiratory depression, bigger dose of opioids, but that's not the job when you're treating dyspnea. Slide 56, benzodiazepines, we have evidence. Thank you, Claire Randall from Arahanui, the real oil on my Midazolam nasal spray, which treats anxiety more than dyspnea. Integral, anxiety management is integral in the management of dyspnea, absolutely. Dyspnea clearly registers in your limbic system. But having said that, in our population, anxiety is not the cause of dyspnea. You can argue with that. Okay. What I'm saying, somebody getting more anxious about their breathing firstly requires their breathing attended to, not their anxiety. Talk a bit more about that. I'm happy using diazepam for breathlessness. We use a lot of clonazepam because we're using it for pain. Some people like lorazepam, not particularly long-acting, and midazolam nasal spray still don't. Midazolam nasal spray still has a place for me. So back into the evidence-free zone. This is my rave. Anxiety is not the cause of dyspnea. In our population, it is. We don't have a bunch of hyperventilators. Dyspnea is the cause of anxiety. Okay, and I guess in different guises over the years, I've regretted not admitting dyspnea patients to the unit. I think I think admission is really helpful. COPD people, exhausted people having to do less helps their breathlessness, but there's also this chance to peek around the anxiety curtain. Admission removes some anxiety, and if you're lucky, you see what's left after the anxiety's been fixed, or you can help with anxiety in a supportive environment. Just remember to make sure you get these people out of bed and treat that, you tread that fine line between deconditioning people and exhausting them. Slide 58, oxygen. I think it's clear it's not better than room air for patients without hypoxia. We have this magic 90% saturation level. But we do know that hypoxic COPD patients gain some long-term survival benefit, and hypoxic palliative care patients whose oxygen recovers with oxygen, I prescribe oxygen for. In the miscellaneous things, Levo in the end of life, I've got this 25 milligrams PRN Q1H. As a sedative thing. Quetiapine is enjoying the honeymoon before the randomized controlled trials kick in, which kill so many of our love affairs like ketamine and midazolam. Pleural drains, it seemed to be a good idea. The local team are starting to put in indwelling pleural drains for people with recurrent effusions, and I think that seems to be working well. Nebulized furosemide is one of those things that come up when you do literature searches, because there, and the Cochrane, I think, is saying that actually there is permissible evidence for nebulized furosemide, 20 milligrams, not necessarily for heart failure, but for breathlessness. But the problem is nobody knows quite how it works, and it seems a little weird, and we've not particularly used it. There may be talk about that in the discussion. Non-invasive ventilation, we're very comfortable with in motor neuron disease. It's the obvious answer to dyspnea from fatiguing muscles. And in the United States, they've done some trials in end-stage cancer patients, and it works better than morphine and midazolam. But I'm not sure that anyone here wants to go there. Slide 60. So this is my summary. Effective symptom management is being comfortable at rest, and the ability to get comfortable at rest. So put that alongside allied health's effective symptom management of function, and they don't replace one another, they sit alongside one another. Slide 61, which is series of problems for the engineer perhaps, even when Captain Kirk is sleeping, we are left with these issues. Tachypnea, is struggling to breathe, dying from a pneumonia. Secretions, we still use buscopan. The evidence is poor. We do know that buscopan is bad for people with reflux and aspiration, and we've got to avoid giving buscopan when people are aspirating. Pneumonia, cardiac issues, I'm just going to go on my next slide. And grunting, I want to mention. Grunting is not that common. I think of it as pursed breathing for the unconscious. It's when you've got somebody dying and they're unconscious and they're doing that. Sound, which is awful. And it's a physiological thing. It's not a distress thing, and we try and normalize it for the family, but actually it is really hard to listen to. Slide 62 is another evidence-free zone, and so it crosses my mind every once in a while that people with really full stomachs with blood or something that are starting to aspirate, you can't put a peg in, but is a nasogastric tube worth it so that they're not tipping all the stuff into their lungs and getting that sort of fulminant secretion sound. With pneumonias, I have used a bit of gentamicin when they're not, particularly when they're dying from something else. Sometimes I give big doses of steroids to try and dampen down the toxic effect. My personal experience is that I find stopping steroids, bang, people with cerebral tumours often, in my mind, get a fulminant pneumonia, get a very purulent pneumonia, and so I'm very reluctant to stop steroids. I choose to die hypovolemic rather than congestive heart. I'm not sure if I should put that in. When you're balancing renal failure and congestive failure. And the last one is an idea that hasn't received a lot of ups really. Aggressive treatment for tachypnea with anti-serotonin and opioids at the end of life. And when somebody's dying from a pneumonia, and we're not talking about dyspnea, we talk about deliberately pushing their wrists down to 8 so that it seems more peaceful for the family. I mean, at the moment we say they're unconscious, it doesn't worry them, but it certainly worries everybody else, so that's perhaps a discussion point. I'm going to finish on slide 63 with another holiday snap. So this is Australian, this is called MATES, it's an example of a multidisciplinary team, because There's some big trials coming through that show the benefit of a multidisciplinary team to treat dyspnea. And this is from Lancet Respiratory, Irene Higginson and Crowd, and integrated palliative care, respiratory care service for patients with advanced disease and refractory breathlessness, showing benefit in dyspnea and quality of life. And so their multidisciplinary team was palliative care, respiratory medicine, occupational therapy, and physiotherapy. And they reviewed that after 6 weeks to find that there is a benefit. Okay. So that's the last slide, slide 64. It's my friend The Guardian, which I think is very...
That will conclude today's conference call. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. You may now disconnect.